You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Oh, excuse me. Hi.
Scopes Monkey Choir.
This is going to be the part two of the interview with Fred Adams, right?
It's episode 63.
Oh, yes. Hi.
And it's the second part of 62.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Hi Ting. Right, this is the second half of an interview with Fred Adams about stars.
And just to remind you where we were last week, they were just cracking each other up about, they were talking about sound and how it usually propagates through air, but that it can also propagate through water or, say, cement. And then there was laughter. And it was part of a general discussion about modes.
I think somehow we were cracking each other up because we were talking about how sound could propagate through water, and one of us put our head down like it was in the water, and then somebody said, or cement.
Yeah, that was a New York joke. Like,
right. Putting my head into the cement.
Discussion about modes. Lots of good stuff in this one. And we'll be back in when it's done. Yes, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so everything likes to be in modes. So stars have modes too. So there's modes of vibration of a star. And you can, in the same way you divide up the modes of vibration of a violin string into one humps and two humps and three humps, you can divide up the modes of vibration of a spherical thing like a star into different modes. Now the easiest mode is just a breathing mode where it expands and contracts.
Oh.
But then you can have, like, one hemisphere doing one thing and the other hemisphere doing another thing. And so on and so forth, and more complicated, more and more. Just like on the violin, when I go from one hump to 12 humps, I get smaller scale structures. Just on a planet, I can get lots of different structures round and round.
And okay? It's three-dimensional. So
it's three-dimensional. So
nine
it's
little, times as many.
Yeah, it's a bit more complicated. Yeah. The physicists would say, oh, we just expanded spherical harmonics. But that doesn't mean much to your audience. But that's our shorthand for saying all those humps.
Right.
No, but we do that. The point is that we do that.
It might be confusing to musicians, too, because a spherical thing is actually not a very good generator of sound waves, because it doesn't, because most material that is solid on the, on the planet doesn't expand and contract like that, but obviously a star.
Yeah, a better, for musicians, a better way to think about these modes are, instead of using the violin and a string as the analogy, it's more like a drum head.
Right, but then that's two.
But that's a two-dimensional drum head.
That wasn't shooting down what you were saying. I was just saying that suddenly I understand how there can be modes of vibration if you think of it as an object that can expand and contract.
Right. The best way to think about it is to say, well, the surface of a star is just like the surface of a drum head, but somehow I'm going to go from a disc shape to all the way around.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And then the math is a little harder, but only a little harder. It turns out the math of a drum head is pretty hard.
Yeah.
But that's what we do, right? So anyway, you get all these vibrations. Like a drum head can go have little patterns all around it, right? So so the stars do the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Now, they basically just vibrate. The whole process of a star vibrating is called astroseismology.
Huh.
Seismology is basically waves in the Earth. Mm-hmm. That the ones we care about are usually the big ones, which are from earthquakes, but little ones you can measure too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So stars vibrate in all these modes, and we can measure that. Now, the state of the art is that for the Sun, which is our nearest star, the measurement of solar seismology is very well developed, and the people who are experts on this have done wonderful work and are working on very, very detailed pictures of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing about those is that the higher order modes, remember the smaller scale modes are the higher order ones, they go deeper and deeper into the Sun.
Oh.
It's not obvious, but it's true. And by measuring them, we get a probe of deeper and deeper into the Sun.
Huh.
And we can then make solar models and compare them to the predictions that you, or from the solar model, predict the vibration modes and then measure the vibration modes and tie it all together. And all works kind of at better than the 1% level.
Uh-huh.
We really know the structure of the Sun really well. And we can prove it independently through this channel of vibrations that you mentioned, right?
Uh-huh.
Now, the state of the art is such that we're just now starting to do this for other stars. Mm-hmm. They're, of course, much further away, much smaller in the sky, much more indirect, so it's a much harder prospect. But that's what people are now working on.
And so you're saying that, by looking at the vibrational modes, you can tell something about also the structure of the star and what materials are at what level?
Well, the basic idea is that a star is a big ball of gas. So you calculate, you make a stellar structure model to understand it. So you calculate its run of
density. I thought it was a giant miasma of plasma.
Well, but it's gas. Plasma is just gas that's ionized, right?
Sorry, that was a they might be giants moment for our musician audience.
Oh, sorry, I missed the reference.
No, please. It's a giant ball of gas.
It's a giant ball of gas, which could be a plasma. And you want to know its temperature, density, and pressure from the middle of the star to the outside of the star. And what you do is you build a model of that, and you calculate the nuclear reaction rates you get from that in the middle, and watch the energy propagate out, and make sure you get the right surface temperature and density for a given mass, and you tie all those things together. And we think we could do that. That's what stellar structure theory gives us, and that's what stellar structure theorists have been doing literally since about 1960.
Uh-huh.
And it works great. But then once you have all that in place, from that same run of temperature, density, and pressure, you can calculate these vibrational modes we just talked about, and then compare them independently with what you see in the case of the sun, how it's vibrating. And it works, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's just further confirmation that the structure that we think we see in the sun or think we calculate in the sun is in fact the structure of the sun.
And that our models are correct.
And that our models are correct.
So what is the relationship of these, of this vibration to, say, solar flares?
Oh, well,
Or is there any?
Well, it's very tenuous in that solar flares are very small-scale things compared to the modes that we've been talking about.
Oh.
So they're kind of little magnetic events on very small scales. So you could think of them as like a really, 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 really high-order harmonic. But
I see, but they're
but
not.
It's so high and local that you don't really need to worry about the global structure of the sun.
Oh, fascinating.
You worry about more of the local magnetic field structure and that
okay.
kind of thing.
Okay, so it does, the vibrational modes do affect the electromagnetic field of the sun?
Well, they affect both the electromagnetic field, which is the radiation coming from the sun, a little bit, and they also will affect the generation of the magnetic field of the sun, right? The sun has a magnetic field just like the Earth has a magnetic field. By coincidence, they're about the surface strength is about the same, about one gauss.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it's also cool that the density of the sun is about 1 gram per cubic centimeter, which is about the density of water, which is the density of you.
Whoa.
The middle of the sun, where all the nuclear reactions take place, has a density about 100 times bigger, but the mean density of the sun is about 1 gram per cubic centimeter.
Amazing.
Just like water.
Amazing. So, okay, so you've got these vibrational modes in the actual sphere of the sun. Then do they somehow get projected out into interstellar space or into the solar system the way sound waves get projected in air?
Well, not much. What we basically see is we see them wiggling around, so you have to actually look at the sun. It's like watching the top of a drumhead. Mm-hmm. That's the best analogy. But unlike the drumhead actually vibrates and then it couples strongly to the sound. So you can propagate that disturbance through the air.
There are molecules in the air
because there's
being disturbed.
Right. So the sun is in a much lower density environment.
Mm-hmm.
There's
space.
Space. It's damn near empty. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So here's a good contrast for you. Where the density of the sun is 1 gram per cubic centimeter, the density of empty space or galaxy is 1 particle per cubic centimeter.
Ha.
Now the difference
is actually higher than I would have thought.
Well, just think about how low that is. If to go from 1 gram per cubic centimeter to 1 particle per cubic centimeter, the difference is something called Avogadro's number,
right?
Which is 6 × 10².
Mm-hmm.
Write that on the board with all those zeros.
Mm,
it's a big number.
Yeah.
It's too much work to even write all those zeros, right? Yeah.
Right.
Big number. Okay.
Okay.
So it's a very, very low density.
Mm-hmm.
So while in principle, never say never, those little fluctuations that we talked about on the surface of the sun will send waves out into space through this medium. The medium is so tenuous that you're never going to hear it. It's not going to make any difference.
Because no particle is going to, mostly particles are just not going to run into their neighbor in order to propagate.
Exactly. So you're really in a different regime. And then there's other things going on that actually beat that effect.
Oh.
The wind, or the sun has a wind that it's spewing out.
Which is actual particles.
Which is actual particles coming from. And those, we call it the solar wind.
Mm-hmm.
And the solar wind is actually dragging the solar magnetic field with it.
Oh.
So there's a part of the solar magnetic field, instead of being a nice, well-defined dipole shape, gets stretched out by this wind. So anyway, that effect, the wind, beats any effect you're going to get from the oscillations in the context that you asked me about.
So do the oscillations affect the solar wind at all? Is there an echo of that within them, or are they...
There might be. Actually, I don't think we know, or I do not know well enough to answer that question.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, in principle, there could be some echo in there. Echo is a good word for that.
So sometimes I've heard about the idea that from distant stars we can get some kind of vibration over, I mean, with an enormous wave over, I think, millions of miles. There was, for instance, a report at some point that a distant star was projecting towards us a sound wave that was a B-flat, but although it was like 1,000 octaves below anything that anyone could hear. But what in the world would they be talking about with that? Would it be an electromagnetic wave that's coming from a distant star, or would it be some kind of vibrational thing that they're just projecting as coming from that star?
Well, I guess I don't know exactly what that news story was referring to.
Yeah, neither do I, obviously.
But in general, what we see primarily from stars are electromagnetic waves, so light waves.
Okay.
And the other things that we could see in principle that people are trying to see are called gravitational waves, which are oscillations in the space-time itself.
Oh.
There's experiments that are going on to measure such things. So far, they haven't.
Okay.
So they did not measure a B-flat with that yet, because they haven't measured anything yet. But they hope to, and hopefully they will, but we're not there yet.
So, but an electromagnetic wave has nothing to do with the propagation of a waveform in a medium, obviously.
Right, right. It propagates, it's its own medium, if you want to.
It is its own medium in the way that...
In a way, yeah.
In the way that light is a wave and a particle, but neither?
Well, it's a little bit different. An electromagnetic wave is light, but it can travel through a vacuum, and that's what I mean. It's basically an oscillation in an electric field and a magnetic field at the same time.
Okay.
You can say it this way, it may or may not help you, but charge gives you an electric field, right? Uh-huh. A moving charge, like a current, gives you a magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
Changing electric fields give you magnetic fields,
mm-hmm.
and changing magnetic fields give you electric fields.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have an electric disturbance that's oscillating, it gives you a magnetic disturbance that's oscillating, which gives you an electric field, which is oscillating, which gives you another magnetic field, which is oscillating. And that whole oscillation will propagate with a given speed. That speed is called the speed of light.
So what the speed light is always the same.
Exactly.
Then. But
that's why light always travels at the speed of light.
But why would the wavelength change then? Couldn't it...
Well, you can do that with different wavelengths and different frequencies, but it all adds up to giving you the same speed.
Oh, right, of course. So the frequency is inversely proportional to the wavelength.
Right.
In the same way that it is for sound.
Right,
yeah. But the speed is always the same because it's
right.
It. Okay.
Yeah.
So that must be what they're talking about. So it must just sort of be an act of imagination to translate it as any kind of tone.
Yeah, I mean, you could always take any frequency and assign it a tone, right?
Right. But that's what radio literally does that.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's frequency modulation and amplitude modulation, but the radio signals are propagating at certain frequencies, right? But they're not the frequencies that you hear the sound at, right?
Right. Right, of course.
But, you know... Anytime you have something that's wiggling at 440 cycles per second, it's concert A, right?
Mm-hmm. Depending on the country that you're in, yeah.
Oh, okay. But you can actually sing that note.
Not off the top of my head.
Oh, you need a tuner to calibrate. Okay.
I don't have absolute pitch. So.
Okay.
I could take a guess, but
your guess would be much better than mine.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm not gonna speculate with no data in this case.
Blatant edit. Blatant edit.
I'm very interested to know what scientists are gonna say about Einstein on the Beach as a show. I'm always interested, actually, to know what scientists think of art that's made about science, because it's so... I mean, most of us as artists don't really understand... Most of us who are not scientists don't really understand scientific concepts like Einstein's at all, except on a really metaphorical level, and I think that kind of metaphor gets people... Well, I want to say gets people in trouble, because it really annoys me when people kind of abuse the metaphors of relativity.
Yeah, sometimes they get abused. Sometimes the metaphors are okay, as long as everybody involved knows we're just kind of using this as a metaphor. We don't really mean it. But some people take it really seriously.
Yes, very seriously.
And incorrectly seriously. And like the usual, lots of people say, well, Einstein says everything is relative, therefore... And that gives you license to do anything.
Right. It becomes cultural relativity.
Or it just means, well, then I can do anything I want.
Right.
Screw you. And it's like, well, that's not really what he meant.
I wonder if there's an equivalent with the idea of the music of the spheres.
Well, we can talk about the music of the spheres a little. The music of the spheres is there are different people meaning different things by that. But the planets have different orbits, right? So the fundamental thing there is you can assign... frequencies to the orbits, right?
Right, this is what...
You can make a transfer...
Well, this is not what got Kepler... This is not what led Kepler wrong, but this is what Pythagoras thought of?
Well...
Before he even knew that there were really...
Well, that was related. There were a couple attempts to build solar system models based on some ideals. Like, one was you have a... all of the platonic solids nested
that was Kepler's, right? And
But the orbits aren't really doing that, right?
Right.
But what you can do is you can take, and I forgot the composer's name that did this, you can take, like, call the orbit of Earth, which is 1 year, call that one note. That's your fundamental, okay? So, C.
Right.
And then Mars has an orbit whose frequency is, it's lower. So you can call that the next note in the scale. And then Jupiter has a lower frequency,
Just literally translate the frequencies of their orbital periods.
You can translate the frequency of the orbital periods into a scale.
And
then with that scale, which are all those different frequencies, you can play a tune, like I was listening to on your blog before you came in.
I think it would be just about as boring. But I've actually never heard of that, or if I have, I didn't remember.
Right. Now, what you'll find interesting is that, there's this guy called Philip Glass, right?
Oh, Philip Glass, yes.
Yeah,
I think I've heard of him.
Yes,
yeah.
Okay. So, in, not last year, but the year before, in 2010, the Rubin Museum in a city you might know called New York.
Mm, yes, I've heard of that too.
It's in Chelsea. Had a series where they paired scientists and artists.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually did one of these with a musician called, she's a rock musician, or sort of rock, Claire Evans Yacht.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, I did this thing about, she's actually a science blogger also, mm-hmm. So I thought you might know her.
Yeah.
But we talked about the Fermi Paradox. So, but anyway, they first asked me to do it with Philip Glass. And I said, well, I'll think about it, because I said, when they said Philip Glass, I said, well, they said, who would you want to do it? And I said, let's do it with Jon Stewart.
The great musician, Jon Stewart.
It was all artists. Oh, it was all artists, okay. Comedians, actors, everybody, right? Yeah. Not just musicians.
Well, you might as well aim high.
Right, so I said, well, let's do Jon Stewart, right? And they said, well, we'll ask him. And then in the meantime, they paired Philip Glass with my friend Greg Laughlin.
Uh-huh.
Greg and I wrote a book together, on the end of the universe. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know about that. But Claire had read our book.
Go out and buy it.
Claire had read my book. That's why she wanted to do it with me. And so she requested me, and we did that. But Laughlin did it with Philip Glass, mm-hmm. right? So what Greg did for that performance or interview, or it's like kind of like what we're doing with Einstein on the Beach, he took extrasolar planetary systems and added and made little sound clips, just like we talked about, where you put one frequency on another.
Mm-hmm. Translating the orbital frequencies into
audible frequencies. And then he played them.
Oh.
And they're really boring.
It's kind of like watching a planet orbit a star.
Yeah, well, here you can even describe in words what it sounds like.
Uh-huh.
And here's why. Because the best you can do, the most musical you can do, is to have the two planets in a 2-to-1 resonance, right?
Uh-huh.
So usually planets are relatively far apart, because if they get too close together, they eject each other. But you can put them pretty close together, and when they get pretty close together, they're often in, or they can be in, a 2-to-1 mean motion resonance. 2-to-1 means there's a 2-to-1 ratio of the periods. But you're a musician, so if I take the frequency and I double it, what do I get?
Get an octave.
An octave.
Yeah.
So what does it sound like? It sounds like a simple chord with a fundamental and an octave.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the other fundamental, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's not the world's most interesting chord.
Mm-hmm.
It's not terrible.
It's not terribly dissonant. No, it's as undissonant as you could get, but
it's a little bit boring. Yeah. So, and if you don't do anything else, you have no overtones, right? So if you just generate a pure sound wave with just one frequency in it, it's dead boring.
That's
right?
Just annoying.
Yeah, it's almost annoying. If it's loud enough, it's annoying, right? Because what makes music have all its interesting textures is all the overtones, right? That's why a trumpet sounds different than a clarinet, or your voice sounds different yet, and so on, right? So
what did you do with Claire Evans?
Oh, well, she writes a science blog, so we decided to talk about the Fermi paradox. So we didn't do anything about music. We just talked about, is there life out there?
Mm-hmm. The Fermi paradox being...
Oh, the Fermi paradox being that the argument is, which Fermi actually first voiced, I think, is let's suppose there's extrasolar or extraterrestrial intelligence, and not just intelligence, but technological civilizations that can build spaceships. Then if you can get from star to star, you can calculate, it doesn't take very long to take over the whole galaxy, right? It's sort of like as soon as we got ships, we being humans, we could travel the whole Earth, and now all of a sudden it's all connected, right?
Yeah.
And that'll happen in a few centuries, and a few centuries is very short compared to the age of the universe or the age of the galaxy. So the question, or the statement is, if there's extraterrestrial civilizations out there, where are they?
Right.
Why haven't we seen them?
Yeah.
Why are we not part of this big galactic...
So basically their absence proves their non-existence.
Well, it doesn't prove anything. It just gives you something to talk about.
Something besides the Drake equation.
Right,
which has been talked to death.
Exactly, right. So it's kind of an interesting question, and there's various ways around it, you know, various
What
thoughts.
If they're not expansionist?
What if they're not expansionist?
Like the Chinese.
Right. Yeah, good point. In fact, that was actually what Laughlin and I said in our book, because we actually addressed this. We said it was kind of the apathetic solution.
Uh-huh. Apathetic aliens.
Yeah. Well, no, but it was actually, let's suppose that we actually understand the physics of DNA. And let's suppose that we really understand it. And it turns out that DNA is just like stars. And what I mean by that is the following. If I make a star, and I put one solar mass of material with this many metals in a big ball, it's always going to do the same thing. It's going to be a star like the sun. Suppose I take DNA, and I put it on a planet that can support life. Suppose that DNA, or the equivalent DNA, will always lead to evolution, which will always lead to a distribution of life forms from bacteria to you, and dolphins, which are...
On a higher level.
On a higher level than us, but we're almost there, right?
Not quite to the mice yet, but...
Oh, yes. You're channeling my alter ego, right? So, the other atoms, yes. So anyway, let's suppose that when you start life with DNA on any planet, it always goes through not exactly the same distribution of life forms, but an equivalent one.
Mm-hmm.
Then, there's actually no point to be expansionist, right? Because life on every planet will always be effectively equivalent. So you don't gain anything by moving to another planet and taking it over. What you do there will be, you know, it's essentially equivalent to what you had before, or what would have been there without you going there. So why go to all the time and money to take it over when it's going to be the same anyway?
Yeah.
Now that puts ego aside.
Right. Right. And which is certainly not a human thing to do.
Well, not in our primitive stage of development.
Right? Oh, right.
I have hopes for us.
Mm-hmm.
Blatant edit. Blatant edit.
Michael Dougherty is the way you pronounce his name. And you were saying he asked for some ideas about how to put relativistic ideas into a musical piece?
Yeah, he was writing a piece about a time machine. I think it was called The Time Machine. And he was just asking about how you would go about putting ideas of relativity into music, right? So, I mean, I did actually contribute to his piece as in the end, but I did have some ideas that we can talk about. So one thing I thought that was kind of interesting is that when you start with classical physics, it's all taking place in three spatial dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And then relativistic physics takes place in four space-time dimensions. So one easy musical device that you could use is to start in 3/4 time, which is very classical. If you imagine Dvorak, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very, or some waltz or something mm-hmm. that's very smooth and classical, and then go to 4/4 time, which would be sort of the modern thing, right?
Maybe, yeah.
You could make it modern, right?
Right.
Just because you've gone from 3/4 to 4/4 doesn't necessarily make the change, but you could do a very classical sounding 3/4 introduction and morph into a very modern sounding 4/4 thing,
mm-hmm.
and that change in signature would be corresponding to developing from, you know, classical physics to modern physics.
Oh, right? I see. So just taking the equivalent of,
yeah,
of sort of three dimensions
yeah.
into four using the time signature.
And you can go even wackier because when you go to modern physics, sometimes in like modern day particle physics, we go to 10 dimensions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we play with lots of different dimensions of space. So one could get more and more crazy and use crazier and crazier time signatures, you know. I always like Brubeck's Take 5, right? So
yeah.
I don't know why, but I really like that piece. And Pink Floyd puts extra beats in some of their things,
uh-huh.
like Money,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I always like that kind of thing when it's done well.
Uh-huh.
And those are two cases when it's done well. So if you could go from 4/4 to either 5/4, 7/8, or something even wackier, right?
Right.
Then you can... you know, sort of add the modernness to it.
Right.
In a way that, it's like we were talking about earlier, it's not a perfect analogy to relativity, it's
right.
just vaguely inspired by the concept
mm-hmm.
of it, right?
Maybe you could use very small notes curled up inside each other so that you can barely hear them.
Well, we could use a lot of grace notes,
string theory.
Right?
Yeah.
Ha!
Thank you, Fred Adams. That was a great conversation.
Yeah, it was totally fun. My favorite part, Mike, can I tell you my favorite part?
Tell me your favorite part.
My favorite part is where you're talking with a world famous physicist and he tells you one of his ideas and you're like, eh.
It was about the aliens.
I know. No, it was totally reasonable because in that particular case, he was talking about something that he doesn't really necessarily have more expertise than you, which is aliens.
Yeah.
But still,
yeah.
I was just impressed.
I don't know.
You just, you know.
Maybe he's been abducted.
Yeah, maybe he has.
Maybe he is an alien.
It's very possible.
Oh, Fred, I didn't mean it. If you're listening, I didn't mean it. Oh, thanks for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir from ScopesMonkeyChoir.com.
We are professional musicians, not scientists.
If you doubt something we've said, don't believe us. Look it up yourself or ask a physicist.
Nevertheless, each episode's page at ScopesMonkeyChoir.com has references and citations. You have to say that. I can't say that word.
References and citations.
Yes, we welcome your feedback. Write to ScopesMonkeyChoir@gmail.com.
Or call the monkey phone and leave a message, 347-788-0330. I'm coming to France. If you're in France, I'll be in France in March.
And
in Italy,
too. We're going to be at Nexus, too.
Oh, yeah. Wait, that's after.
Oh, after.
Yes,
oh,
but
yeah.
We are going to be at Nexus, yes.
Yes.
We might even sing.
Yeah, so see you next week.
Bye.